Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
So how long have you known Vince's
Right. You know,
I met Vince's dick in 1954.
Right, like, I'm not just...
Water's like, cold.
Yeah, it's deep, too. Deep, too. Right, I need to know what's what.
I love Mudbone.
Mudbone's the best. It's actually one of my favorite jokes. Like, that's actually one of my favorite jokes.
What? The one about the...
Yeah, the water's cold and it's deep, too. Yeah. Other joke, my friend Rick Younger, who's actually on Broadway right now. He's in Mean Girls, the musical.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He plays the Tim Meadows character.
Oh, get out of here.
He was a stand-up. He's still a stand-up. And he had a joke. It's the dumbest joke, but it's the funniest joke in the world to me, where he says something, 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 because, you know, one monkey don't stop no show. Pause. Unless, of course, it's a one monkey show. It's the funniest thing in the world to me.
So you really like your friend?
I do. But yeah, it's deep too. It's deep too. That might be my favorite joke of all time. Like joke. Like, you know, what people tell you. Yeah.
I understand. But I never think of it as a joke.
What do you think of it as?
Because I just think of it as the story that Mudbone's telling.
But it's got a setup.
It does. But he still tells it in the midst and of it's his story.
Oh, no. But I mean, just separately. Just that. No, just yes. Sort of clean. Yeah.
No, I hear you. Yeah. But I just don't hear, like, you know, it's not Henny Youngman.
Right. Setup.
Joke. You know Rodney Dangerfield
complication.
Joke. Right. You know.
Yeah.
But it is funny.
Yeah.
It is. It's
but you're right. Funny. It is more of a story. Sort of, but I think that's Richard Pryor, though.
Oh, yeah, most certainly.
Like how much?
Especially at that point in his career.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know the funniest joke that I've ever heard, but I'm fairly certain it was told by Stephen Wright.
Okay.
Stephen Wright.
And he told jokes.
Yes.
He told distinct jokes.
Yes.
Did you ever watch, what was the name of that show? I feel like Louis C.K. hosted it, where he had a bunch of comedians and they were talking about each other's joke styles.
No.
I forget the name. I think it was on HBO. But there's this one moment that utterly fascinates me. Mm-hmm. Where Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock are both talking about hearing each other. Mm-hmm. And Jerry Seinfeld says that Chris Rock used to have this joke about black porn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how it was kind of low budget and this, that, and the other. But the fascinating thing, and they pointed it out on the show, is because it's like Louis C.K., Chris Rock, Jerry Seinfeld, and Rick Gervais.
Okay.
Which, you know, part of it, they were saying Rick Gervais at that time wasn't really a stand-up.
Not at all.
So they were talking about the art, the craft of stand-up. And when Jerry Seinfeld retold the Chris Rock joke, he told it like Jerry Seinfeld. So the rhythm of it, like it was a very clean break between the beginning and the end of it. And it kind of speaks to what you were just saying about Mudbone.
Right.
And, you know, oh, you know, the water's cold, it's deep too. And I said, oh, that's a joke. And is it really a joke? Because like you said, it's part of this long
narrative that he's,
and you know, that's been my argument about Eddie Murphy for years, that for all of the Eddie Murphy is in the Richard Pryor school, I think Eddie Murphy in a lot of ways is also in the Bill Cosby school.
Oh, yeah.
Because Eddie Murphy tells these long narratives, which, you know, like you said, Richard Pryor did it as well. But when we talked about it, we would talk about Bill Cosby.
Yes.
And it's part of my, you know, my Eddie Murphy is this fantastic storyteller that I don't think he gets enough credit for. But anyway, look it up. Because Jerry Seinfeld tells the joke. Like, he retells it, but he tells it like Jerry Seinfeld. But then Chris Rock tells it.
Mm.
And you can see the difference. Same joke, both funny, the way both of them tell it.
I was wondering, like, what did Jerry get it over?
He gets it over. It's funny. You know, it's weird because obviously he's a white guy doing the, you know, black people do it like this, white people do it like that. Mm-hmm. Which even that, the fact that they mine something that hackneyed and make it funny. Where you realize you're looking at two masters at their craft.
Yeah. Well, they certainly are considered masters at it, and they've got the wallets to prove it. I don't know. Like, they both are great. They both are good. Very good. I think that Louis C.K. is very good as well.
Absolutely.
It's funny you were bringing up Eddie Murphy. I think Eddie Murphy, you can definitely see the Bill Cosby in him.
Yeah.
And while you can also see the influence of Richard.
Yeah.
Richard started off pretty much like Eddie Murphy too. Heavily influenced by Bill Cosby. You could hear the Bill Cosby in his act.
Right.
And then somewhere along the line, as he's maturing, Richard becomes a lot more introspective,
right,
and turns into the Richard Pryor that is one of the two greatest comedians of all time,
right?
You know, right up there, him, George Carlin,
right?
Eddie Murphy, because he moves so quickly and steadfastly into movies as a comedian, never made that turn,
right? So
he never made the turn past the Bill Cosby influence. His was Bill Cosby influence with sprinklings of Richard Pryor and thus some of him.
And the profanity.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Right, but the profanity, like you said, the profanity was never what made Richard Pryor Richard Pryor. Like you said, it's the introspection, the honesty where, you know, we've talked when he comes up, we've talked about this before, like you almost have to hold yourself back from going into a Richard Pryor thing where you almost don't even want to call him a comedian.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, he's just sort of this truth sayer. And a lot of times the truth was his truth.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah. I always thought that was,
I don't know how we got onto this. Oh yeah. And it's cold too. Is deep too.
Yeah. Mudbone.
Right. Mudbone.
This is where Mudbone took us.
This is where Mudbone took us, which is a very Richard Pryor kind of
thing.
Yeah, there exactly. You go. All right. Hello, welcome once again to another stop on the Michaud Mission, Two Men, One Podcast, Every Black Film Ever Made. I am your host, Vincent Williams of It's All Soul, Wednesdays 8 to 10 p.m. on G-Town Radio. And I'm joined as always.
Yo, what's up? Holla at your boy. This is Len, a.k.a. the Bat Tribble.
And on this stop, we are spending some time with a bona fide cinematic classic.
Yup.
1958, The Defiant Ones, directed by legendary director Stanley Kramer, starring legendary actor Tony Curtis, as well as legendary actor Sidney Poitier. But before we get into all of these legends and decide whether or not this film lives up to its reputation, as always,
we've got letters. We've got feedback from each and every one of you that hits us up on Instagram and Twitter, as well as on Facebook at Michaud Mission, likes and follows us. Also emails us at MichaudMission@gmail.com. We can receive messages in our inbox on Facebook, and we received a message from Juwan Blaylock.
Hey, Juwan.
Who said, I'm new to the podcast, Oh my God. I cried laughing at the hilariously angry review of Acrimony.
A modern classic.
Mm-hmm.
The review, not the film.
Yes. Thank you guys so much. This is my new favorite podcast. I can't wait to listen to past reviews.
Oh, well, thank you and welcome. And you got a bunch for you.
Oh, yes, we do.
I'm always happy when people say they just found us and they can't wait to listen to past reviews, because it's nice that there's something. It's like when you find a new show mm-hmm. on Netflix.
That's true.
And you realize it's like 5 seasons.
Yeah, it's like, ooh.
And it's like, ooh, that is fantastic.
Yeah.
So
that's pretty cool.
Thank you and welcome.
Hey, now, that review of Acrimony.
Yes.
Which was pretty much just my
review. Yes, it was. I was the peanut gallery.
That I can't remember what episode that came on.
Right.
But it was. Can that count as our review of Acrimony?
No, it cannot.
So we actually still...
At some point, we have to watch it.
Oh! No!
Yeah. I think it was before Attack the Block. I was listening to that a couple of days ago.
So be on top of Attack the Block?
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, well. Yeah. Anyway. Let's keep it moving. Ernie Suggs hit us up.
Hey, what's up, Ernie?
And he mentioned that on the Fences episode.
Yes.
People digging in the crates.
Yeah, that's what you got to do.
You mentioned that Lana Turner played the tragic mulatto.
Yes.
It was actually Susan Conner.
Yes, in the
1950s version.
Yes, of
Imitation of Life.
Yes. You're absolutely right. Of Life,
right.
Yes, and thank you for correcting us.
We were incorrect. And he also points out that Susan wasn't black either.
No, she was not.
Let us know. There is... Ooh, this is interesting. Did you see this link that our man Aaron Fry posted?
What's up, Aaron?
In the Facebook group about a... Let's see what's happening here. There is Secrets of the Dead, The Woman in the Iron Coffin.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a special that's going to be on PBS... Let's see, on October 4th, 2011, construction workers were shocked to uncover human remains in an abandoned Elmhurst neighborhood of Queens, New York.
Oh.
So great was the level of preservation, witnesses first assumed they had stumbled upon a recent homicide.
Wow.
That is insane. Wow, that's yeah, crazy.
Just in time for, you know, Halloween month.
Oh, don't say that. Buried in an elaborate and expensive iron coffin, the body belonged to a young African-American woman who died in the first half of the 19th century.
Wow.
Before the Civil War and the federal abolishment of slavery.
Wow.
Secrets of the Dead follows forensic archaeologist Scott Warnish and a team of historians and scientists as they investigate this woman's story and the time in which she lived, revealing a vivid picture of what life was like for the free African-American people in the North.
Wow, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you, Aaron.
Yeah, so we're going to look for that on your local PBS station.
Good looking out.
The special Secrets of the Dead, The Woman in the Iron Coffin.
Okay.
That is, wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. That is definitely incredible.
I love the Michelle Missionaries.
Ah, vacation. A well-deserved break for training, for assignments, TDYs, and the daily grind of military life. This vacation's all R&R because you've been making smart choices. First Command may not know when you'll next be off duty, but we can help you stay on track for the future so you can relax and enjoy the moment.
Sir, can I get you another mango smoothie?
From enrollment to retirement, First Command is there, coaching your financial future every step of the way. Learn more at firstcommand.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg.
In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
We got a new Michelle missionary that joined us in the Facebook group.
Okay.
Anthony Sterling.
Yes.
Joined just yesterday.
Yes. And welcome, Anthony.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Let's see. What else do we have here? There is currently being developed.
Yes.
A third Sister Act.
Yeah, I saw that, but Whoopi Goldberg is not going to be in it.
Whoopi Goldberg will not be in this
film. I don't really understand the point of how you do it without Whoopi Goldberg.
I don't understand the point of doing a third Sister Act.
Yeah, me either.
I don't think there's a need for a third
Sister Act. It's a concept that doesn't age that well. And not because it's offensive, it's just... it's one of those screwball high concepts that we all sort of bought
and
in the late 80s and 90s.
And as Mike Zablinski points out in the comments, it's a concept that has already been taken over and done in threes by the Pitch Perfect movies to a degree.
I've never seen one Pitch Perfect film.
If you've seen one Pitch Perfect film, you've seen them all.
Is there someone in disguise as a nun?
Well, no.
Okay.
However, they aren't... well, the third one wasn't that great. The first one is actually a cute movie. And okay. The second one is okay.
Okay.
The second one's okay. I think they because I understand that I think there's a fourth one coming. I think they definitely worn out their welcome. But... it's not a bad. The first one is you'll stick around for the music.
Yeah,
it's a little infectious.
Right.
But after that, it wears thin.
Okay,
and gets thinner and thinner down the line. But I don't see the need for a third Sister Act.
No, me either. I actually didn't see the need for a second one until I saw it and said, okay, I see what they did here.
Okay, y'all got lucky.
Right, like, so. Well, you know, somehow they pulled it off. Like, they actually looked at the concept and said, how can we expand on it? But I don't know how you can keep doing that, especially not 20 years later.
Speaking of taking a concept
of
a movie and trying to expand on it, Halle Berry and Lena Waithe.
Yes.
Are set to produce a TV series.
Yes.
Quasi-adaptation of Boomerang.
Right, I think it's supposed to be a sequel.
For BET.
Yeah.
Right.
Or a continuation.
It's really a continuation. Right. It's not a reboot of the story or anything like that. It's a continuation of the story.
Right.
That tells the story of... let's see, Marcus and Angela, who are the Eddie Murphy and Halle Berry characters in the movie, their daughter, and Jacqueline, who was Robin Givens' character, her son, them in today's society moving on, you know, and stepping out of their parents' shadows.
Right, and it's going to be on BET.
It is going to be on BET. Lena Waithe is going to be a producer on it with Halle Berry, is going to be an executive producer. Ben Curry Jones has been hired as the showrunner. And
I'm not familiar with him.
Ben Curry Jones?
They have anything that he's...
let's see. I'm not familiar with Mr. Jones either. Mr. Jones, he has worked as a story editor and a writer on Underground, as well as Hand of God, and a few episodes of Insecure.
Okay. All right.
So he actually has been in the producing game for a little bit. What do we think of?
Well, at first of all, there was not one single solitary detail of this that I was interested in except Lena Waithe. But then when you said it just now, I didn't know that she was just producing.
Oh, okay.
I thought she was going to be involved on the creative side. So then,
well, that's no. She's like she is more of a hands-on producer. So okay. She's definitely she's developing it.
Well, suffice it to say, Lena Waithe is the only reason that I would keep this on my radar at all. Mm. And then, would you say his name was Ben?
Ben Curry Jones.
It sounds like he's been involved in some stuff. I mean, I'll watch it.
He's been involved in some good stuff. Yeah, like stuff. I'll watch it. I love Insecure. Like, Hand of God on Amazon.
Yeah, I'm sure Halle Berry will be in the first episode. It's a cameo.
Okay, maybe.
It's a cameo. And, you know, maybe.
But that might.
Maybe Robin Givens will be on the first episode, too. Like, just cameos.
Well, if you're going to get the two of them, you can't get Eddie?
Oh, come on, stop. You're going to have to listen to his music. I made some reggae that y'all got to listen to for 2 hours to get me on for 5 minutes, which right. I think is a fine price to pay, but
not even 5 minutes.
Nobody, right.
All you gotta do is just see him in the shower.
Right. Show him drop off his daughter and then he goes off. But yeah, I'm not really that interested.
Lena Waithe is actually the name that is absolutely getting me to the door.
Yeah.
At that. I don't have a problem with it because, you know, hey, this is TV. This has been TV forever.
Yeah.
Taking, you know, properties and, you know, adapting them, either rebooting them or doing sequels on them or stuff like that, trying to flip the script on them. So I don't knock them for that. And it has worked pretty well for Netflix with Dear White People and She's Gotta Have It. So who's to say that it can't work for BET?
Right. And certainly everyone is continuing. Like a lot of these 90s properties are being continued and,
right.
You know, not even rebooted.
Right. They're not even being rebooted. They're right. being continued.
Which speaks to, you know, on the Facebook group, we had a conversation a couple of weeks ago, how, I mean, obviously there are more important aspects of what happened with Bill Cosby's court case, but it's immensely frustrating that they can't do Different World. Like they can't bring Different World back because it's the perfect moment to have it back. It's been like 20 years, which means that Dwayne and Whitley's kid is in college. Mm-hmm. So like it's actually the perfect moment.
It's the perfect moment.
Like that whole cast, their kids are at Hillman now. You take one of those characters and have them, you know, work at Hillman. Mm-hmm. And it's seamless.
Yeah, but do we really... Okay, just like Lena Waithe is the only thing that's getting you to the table here on Boomerang.
Right.
Because actually, did we really care about the children of Jacqueline and Marcus and
right,
and
right, Angela? Right.
No, they didn't have kids in the movie, so why would we care?
Right.
Right? So that's the only thing that's really getting you there. And they actually could have just came up with a show based on this.
Right, like on a black advertising firm.
Right, but you tie in Boomerang to get, you know, nostalgia.
And right,
you,
right. And probably
get more eyes.
Help it get, right, greenlit. Okay. Yeah, no, I absolutely see it.
So, in that vein, you're talking about, you know, we could see Different World. Whitley and Dwayne's kids, they're now in college. So you could kind of reboot Different World.
Right.
We've got Different World. We've got Different World. You've got Different World two different places. You've got it on Freeform, the cable channel, with Grown-ish, which is the
sure
the you know the spinoff from
right, Black-ish. Which in a lot of ways kind of occupies that position. It occupies with that Black-ish, position, yeah.
Right. And then if that's not maybe meaty enough for you, which I can maybe understand,
right? You have Dear White People.
You got Dear White People.
No, I get it. I think you're absolutely right that eight well. Actually, you don't. Actually, you don't. Because neither Grown-ish nor Dear White People take place at a HBCU. Dear White People is an Ivy League school. It's a fictional Ivy League school. Right. Okay. And Grown-ish is basically UCLA.
Yeah.
We all know that I am a fan of the work and wit of Anika Noni Rose. But the quad...
Oh, yeah. I forgot about the
just
quad.
It was too soapy to really, I think, capture the intricacies. Like, I think there's a lot of dramatic gold to be mined mm-hmm. about an HBCU in 2018. That Different World, it's perfect. Like, it's a perfect vehicle, but, you know, here we are.
That brings to mind one last question, and I don't know if we can answer this question.
Okay.
Maybe some of our listeners that are in the business can answer this question. I was watching on Netflix the other day. I was watching Ozark.
Okay.
With Jason Bateman.
I still have not watched this. I know.
Okay. But anyway.
Funny thing, I was the other thing that was on the Attack the Block, that's where I was mad at you about Black Mirror. That you hadn't watched Black Mirror yet.
Oh yeah.
So now you can yell at me about Ozark, and I know. I actually told you were fucking up. So now I'm fucking up. There you go. I had them close together, Lynn, so you can bleep them both. They're right there together.
Yes.
You can bleep them.
Because you just fucked up.
Yeah, see, it's three. It's a hat trick.
I think in for a penny, in for a pound.
In for a penny, in for a pound. So yeah, I know, but you were watching Ozark, which I haven't watched. Go ahead.
However, but I was watching Ozark, and I was admiring the quality of the show.
Yeah.
Like just the drama, the tension that they were so expertly building up in the scene that I was watching, right? Not giving anything away, but I was just admiring that quality,
mm-hmm.
right? And then for, what happened? Oh, so then for a change of pace, because we watched like a couple of episodes of it, me and Lily Tribble, we turned to something else just as a change of pace.
Okay.
And she wanted to, with Empire coming on, she wanted to catch up on Empire.
Okay.
We watched the last episode from last season or something.
Okay.
Like that. So we turned that on. I don't care about Empire.
Sure,
Empire, but I watched it. And immediately, I was struck by, to me, of course, the difference in quality.
Right.
Right? Now, both shows, they have different goals dramatically.
Absolutely.
Empire is definitively written to be more of a soap.
Yeah.
It's written to be more melodramatic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay? However, to me, even though it's written to be melodramatic, there was a difference in just the quality of the direction
mm-hmm.
of the show.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And it struck me so hard that I just wondered, okay, is it truly just about developing what your show is going to be about and the look of it, and then you just hire directors that can simply do that?
Yeah.
Or do you actually, hire directors and tell them this is what you have to do?
Right.
You know? Because it just boggled my mind that if I was a director hired on to do an episode of Ozark.
Yeah.
And then, because I'm a camera for hire.
Yeah.
So you hire me to direct an episode of Empire. If I'm being true to myself, I'm trying to bring the same level of quality to both.
Right.
So why am I not trying to develop the same type of tension, even if the words are different?
Right.
Why am I not still trying to develop the same type of tension, at least from the mood and from my direction right. of this?
I mean, whether you're talking about Ozark, whether you're talking about Empire, I mean, we've talked about it. Like even a show like Queen Sugar.
Okay.
Which has an actual murderer's row of directors every single episode.
Right.
But it has a distinct look.
And feel.
And tone. Feel.
Yes, yes.
That is continuous.
Which is what your showrunners is
right. So, maintaining. So, I think part of it is just the nature of television.
Mm-hmm.
That, this is the look. This is the aesthetic. This is what we're trying to get across from the point of view of a series.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have that consistency. between episodes.
See, but okay, and that's a good, like, to me, Queen Sugar, Queen Sugar and Greenleaf are going after the same audiences.
Oh, I completely disagree with that.
You know, you think so? Oh, I think Greenleaf is more melodramatic.
I think Greenleaf is like yeah, in my house we call Greenleaf like the child of Queen Sugar and like the haves and the have nots. Like it's right in the middle. Because it's like, because Greenleaf gets soapy.
Okay, yeah.
Greenleaf gets soapy.
Yeah, that's what...
But at the same time, like, it's better than... Like, I think Greenleaf is better than like, Dynasty used to be. Mm-hmm. Like, just quality-wise. Mm-hmm. That's because Greenleaf has that one parent that's like a prestige...
But don't you think that Queen Sugar, to a degree, some of their storylines can almost be like the same type of storylines that you will find in a soap opera. But it's just a matter of the writing and the direction. But the storyline itself.
I think there was one storyline that I thought cleaved a little soapy. And, you know, I don't know who's caught up. Well, I guess it's off. The season's over.
Yeah.
Like at the point where, damn, now I forget everybody's name. Robert, because he's always going to be Robert from The Cosby Show to me, was halfway going to date both sisters.
Yeah.
I thought, okay, that's, all right, this is cleaving a little soapy. Mm-hmm. But besides that, I actually think plot-wise... I don't think it's that soapy.
No, it's not. It doesn't play like
when
like
I
that.
Think about you, just on the level of plot. Like, you know, this is the plot of it. And I feel like Greenleaf is way more plot driven.
Which is soap.
Yeah. And way more exciting. If you will. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, oh my goodness. Like every episode of Greenleaf at the end, it's like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's played for that moment. You know, yeah.
As opposed to at the end of every episode of Queen Sugar, like, I realize I haven't been breathing for 40 minutes because I'm so emotionally vested in the lives of these fictional characters, and I don't want bad things to happen to them.
Right.
And then I get to the end, and it's like, we made it through another episode.
Okay, fair enough.
Poor Aunt Va coughs or something, and it causes a crisis in my house. Why's Aunt Va coughing?
Y'all don't see her coughing?
Right. So...
Also, just in time for Halloween, October 26th, we're going to do our annual Halloween screening right here in the city of Brotherly
Love. Yes, sir.
The Michelle Mission presents Sugar Hill. Ooh, gangster zombies.
That's right.
Wait for it. Sugar Hill screening, 8:30 p.m., Friday, October 26th at Amalgam Comics and Coffee House, our annual Halloween screening. Summer Willow Fitch is concocting another strange, insidious brew for the evening. Come on out. It's completely free. We want you all to come out and just have a good time and rock and roll with Vince and me and Ariel Johnson of Amalgam Comics and Summer Willow Fitch of the Ladies Love Hip Hop podcast as we sit down and watch the 1970s blaxploitation horror classic Sugar Hill. It's going to be fun.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Let's get into it. After these messages, we're going to be listening. Well, what are we going to be doing? We're going to be reviewing The Defiant Ones. Hey there, missionaries. It's fundraising time again at WPPM Philly Cam 106.5 FM, and the Michelle Mission is doing their part. on Saturday, October 27th at 1 p.m., Vince and myself, the Bat Tribble, Len, will be doing a very special live episode of The Michelle Mission. We're not sure exactly what we're going to be talking about just yet. The important thing is that we are going to be trying to raise $500 for Philly Cam. And we need your help. All we need you to do is listen to the show at that time and call in. And if we make our goal, each and every one of you that helps us get there will receive a very special commemorative edition of The Last Dragon, which will have on it a audio commentary from The Michelle Mission. It's going to be a whole lot of fun. Believe me, I'm looking forward to recording this for you. So help us make Philly Cam reach its goal on Saturday, October 27th. You can tune in to phillycam.org/listen, or you can go to that website and also find out all the crazy things and incredible things that Philly Cam does for the city of Philadelphia.
Go on, tell me all that big talk about Johnny Potatoes when the chain's off and nobody chasing you.
Come on. You can't, can you? You can't because you're nothing. You're not even a man. You're a monkey on a stick. That crack of mob back there, they pulled the string and you jumped.
I'm a strange-colored man in a white South town. How long you think before they pick me up?
Get off my back. I ain't married to you. Now, what do I care? Come on!
You married to me, all right, Joker. And here's the ring. But I ain't going south on no honeymoon now. We going north. Time's gonna come, Joe. The time's gonna come.
Go on! Burn their eyes out!
Can't go lynching me. I'm a white man.
Run! Come on!
I can't make it. I can't make it.
The Defiant Ones, a 1958 crime film which tells the story of two escaped prisoners, one white, played by Tony Curtis, and one black, played by Sidney Poitier, who are shackled together and must cooperate in order to survive. By the end of the journey, I think they find that they have more in common than not. Directed by Stanley Kramer, it won the Academy Award for Cinematography, Black and White, and Original Screenplay. A bona fide classic, this was the choice of Mr. Lin Webb.
Yeah. The Defiant Ones has long been one of my favorite movies. Like, it's probably in my top 20.
Oh, okay.
Of my favorite movies. For a couple of reasons. One is because of Tony Curtis. I was introduced to Tony Curtis very young, at a young age, sitting downstairs in my basement watching an Abbott and Costello movie. And I think it may have been Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it went off and I just sat there. And the next thing that came on was Houdini.
Okay.
Which was a 1950s, 1960s movie where Tony Curtis played Harry Houdini. And I just sat there and watched that film. And I fell in love with Tony Curtis from there because, to me, he was Houdini. And he was cool. And after that, maybe a few years later than that, I ran across Tony Curtis again in a film that's one of my 10 favorite films of all time and considered one of the 10 greatest films of all time, Some Like It Hot, with him and Jack Lemmon and Marilyn Monroe in her best role. A classic comedy by Billy Wilder. So when I then started going down the rabbit hole of finding more Tony Curtis to take in. One, from my viewpoint, he was like this action comedy guy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So lo and behold, somewhere along the lines, I come across the Defiant Ones. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, check this out. It's Tony Curtis. Can't be so bad. And then I see that Sidney Poitier was in it. I liked Sidney Poitier. Why? Because by this time, I had fallen in love with Sidney Poitier by way of his movies with Bill Cosby. So when I'm seeing Sidney Poitier in those three movies, definitely comedies, and now I'm seeing him with, to me, an action comedy star in Tony Curtis,
right?
I'm like, oh, this is going to be a good Saturday. Let me sit down and watch the Defiant Ones.
Right.
It's a weird name for a comedy. What do I know?
Right, right.
You know, let me get some popcorn real quick. Probably got a bowl of Captain Crunch and sit down for a good old time. Ooh. Was I mistaken? Ooh, this is what they call those dark comedies. I don't know about this one.
Right.
I'm not laughing. And yet, I can't look away. I cannot look away from this film. When I'm watching this, I'm probably 13, 14 years old.
Nice.
So some of what they're trying to get across is hitting me, but it's not really hitting me like it's supposed to.
Right.
I returned to this film in my 20s. And returning to it in my 20s, now, you know, after college and everything like that, a little bit more schooled. You know, I don't know if I'm woke yet, but I'm at least, you know, my eyes are open.
Right.
And I'm watching this film. And by now, I know more of Tony Curtis. I know more about Sidney Poitier, who they actually, these two actors really are, in their careers and at this point in their careers when they did this movie in 1958.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm watching this film now under completely different eyes. And when I watch it then, I realize that this is just an amazing piece of filmmaking that I am watching mm-hmm. here from Stanley Kramer. First of all, in the 20, when upon revisiting it, I'm struck by there's no music in this movie.
Nope.
There's not an opening song. There's not a closing song.
That's right.
There is no the only music you hear is coming over a radio every once in a
right,
while.
Right, right. Or Sidney Poitier singing.
Or Sidney Poitier, long gone.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the music that's in just like, ooh. So, which then makes it that and it being a black and white movie. Because 1958, you didn't have to do movies in black and white. There was color.
Right.
So it was, you know, specifically black and white, which, you know, it just makes the whole racial, you know, immediacy of the movie just that much more striking. The sparseness of the script, because there's a, you know, there's lines, it's a script. But there's a lot of moments where it's just these two guys on the run.
Right.
It's just them dealing with the atmosphere of what they have to deal with. There's a lot of moments where you hear nothing but this unrelenting rain and downpour that they are in. Right. And I'm just really I'm just really struck by the moments that this movie is creating. This is when I'm watching it in the 20s. Fast forward maybe another 10 years, revisit the film again. When I'm watching it now, I am watching it. Now I'm considering myself like whatever woke is, I'm woke.
Right.
So I'm watching this film and now I'm listening to the dialogue that is there.
Yeah.
And there is dialogue there that is just some of the meatiest dialogue that you will hear in any movie. And just imagining that it was in 1958. There's this whole bit that they do when they are on the run from because they were on a chain gang,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they escape. And they're in the woods. It's late at night. They've cooked themselves up, I think, a frog.
Yeah.
And as they're eating this frog, they have this running dialogue between the two of them that goes from talking about the animals in the woods to talking about Tony Curtis, who was just this, you know, they're both escaped convicts, but Tony Curtis is like this big dreamer and just dreams of, you know, every day. I guess, you know, when you're in prison, you have to have some place where you can go in your mind that takes you away out of your circumstance.
Right.
It hit. His place was dreaming of himself being rich, being one of the, you know, being one of the, what he calls Charlie Potatoes.
That's right.
The rich guys. And so it goes from talking about the animals to Tony Curtis about his dreaming about being one of the Charlie Potatoes to Sidney Poitier's character, Noah or Cullen, popping his balloon a little bit. Then it segues into Tony Curtis not liking the words thank you, and he has this whole soliloquy on how he doesn't like using the word thank you, which then dovetails into Sidney Poitier talking about how he doesn't like the word nigga.
Yeah.
And it's probably about a good 5 minutes of dialogue, and it ends. Oh my God, it ends.
Yeah.
On this line. Look, I'm gonna give you, ladies and gentlemen, you know, I'm sorry, you know, with all due respect to my man, to Dorian and Omar and Ryan and Simone and all the actors that listen to us. But there's this one piece of dialogue here, and I highlighted it because I love this so much. I had to find a script.
Yeah.
Because it's not a quote. When you look for quotes in the movie, they don't use this quote. And I'm just going to go here real quick. Give me a moment. I'm sorry, Vince. I'm sorry. All right, here we go. Because Tony Curtis is telling him about, you know, how Tony Curtis, who goes by the Sidney Poitier keeps calling Joker. And he's telling Sidney Poitier's character how you've got to deal with, you know, the word nigga.
Yes.
You've got to deal with that, man. And let's see, Tony Curtis says, well, that's what you are, ain't it? It's like calling a spade a spade. I'm a honky. I don't try to argue out of it. And then Sidney Poitier breaks it down for him. Tony Curtis says, you know, I'm a honky. I don't try to argue out of it. You can call me a bohunk. I don't mind.
Right.
And then Sidney Poitier says, you ever hear tell of a bohunk and a woodpile, Joker? You ever hear tell of catch a bohunk by the toe? Depends on how you mean it. How'd you mean it? Don't crowd me. I don't make up no names. No, Sidney Poitier says. You breathe it when you're born, and you spit it out from then on. That name sure bugs you, don't it? Well, that's the way it is. You're stuck with it. Because I didn't make any rules. No, but you sure live by them. Everybody lives by them. Even the swamp animals. Even that weasel. What, you calling me a weasel?
Here, I'll let you read it from my notes.
No.
I wrote it down.
I'm calling you a white man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
That's the end.
Yeah.
You really need to hear the whole thing. That chunk of dialogue right there should be like must see that piece of the film should be like must see movies for every actor. It is just spot on. And I don't think, you know, Sidney Poitier, he's gotten his accolades. He's won Academy Awards and everything. Tony Curtis, he's only had one Oscar nomination to his name, and that was for this film.
Yeah.
And this film, Sidney Poitier was, for the first time, a black man was nominated for a lead role in this film. They were both nominated for lead roles.
Yeah.
Neither one of them had to settle for supporting roles. That is just how devastatingly phenomenal the acting is by these two men in this film. From the beginning of this movie, when it starts off, you see them on this bus, and they're totally adversarial to one another, even though they're chained to one another. They're totally adversarial to one another. And yet, their chemistry of just their acting chops pops off the screen. And because of that, the arc that they go through, which is not leaned on heavy. It's not like, you know, you hear some words of like, you know, like they never call each other friend.
Right.
You know, you never see some like kumbaya moment in between them.
Right.
But you can feel it. You can sense it by the shared experience that not only they are having with one another, but also the shared experiences that they're sharing with one another as they each reach a level of understanding of who the other is and why they are at this point, why they were in this prison. And that all then just culminates at the end of the film in, you know, one of the more striking images and it's the image that everybody takes away from this film. When they're running after this train to catch this train to freedom. And Sidney Poitier gets on the train and he's reaching back for Tony Curtis. And then you get a close-up of their hands in each other. Sidney Poitier's hand, Cullen's hand on top, pulling up the white man.
Yeah.
Trying to pull the white man to safety, to freedom. And Tony Curtis unable to make it. And they both come tumbling off the train. But that one striking image of their hands clasped together as it is in 1958 in these United States of America is an incredible image, an incredible striking image on the screen. I would have loved to have seen this on a full-blown Cinerama screen.
Yeah.
To just see those hands fill that screen.
Here's the thing. You're saying 1958. I think that this has a more nuanced examination of race relations and how you know white privilege,
mm-hmm.
the way whiteness has been used as a wedge,
yes,
between poor white people and poor black people. I mean even, you know, the part that you were just quoting, that, you know, as I said, I wrote down the last part of it, the passive way that white people exist within a racist system.
Mm-hmm.
It's so incredibly nuanced. I would love to see it in 2018 because I don't think we talk about race the way that Stanley Kramer and this script put forward the way it, you know, frankly, needs to be talked about.
Yeah.
And the way it works. Yeah. Everything you just said. And then, you know, see if I can add, I think it was appropriate that you said you sort of reverse engineered knowing about Sidney Poitier from the Sidney Poitier and Bill Cosby movies.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I realized is that first, when I think of Tony Curtis, I always think of him as a comedic actor.
Okay.
Like, I know he did other stuff, but when I think about it, I always go to some Like It Hot and you know, it's a mad, mad, mad world and just sort of random things.
He's not in a mad, mad.
Not mad, mad world.
Oh, you're thinking about The Great Race.
Yeah, yeah. Where he's, you know, he's got that kinetic energy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think Sidney Poitier works really well
with an actor that has that energy.
Yeah.
So even though it's obviously not a comedy, that energy that you get between Poitier and Curtis, I think, is very much paralleled with Poitier and Cosby.
Right.
Because it's that same kind of, you know, you have this kinetic bounce of the comedic actor. And then Sidney Poitier has this coolness. Mm-hmm. Not cool as in, hey, but cool as in this emotional restraint that he has. That the alchemy is fantastic. I think the script is amazing.
Man.
I think this script is amazing.
It's so smart.
And frankly, the best compliment I can give the actors, not just Sidney, because I think the whole cast is great.
Yeah, Theodore Bickel as the sheriff.
Right. Lon Chaney is in here for a moment. And you forget, and if you know anything about Lon Chaney, this was actually part of his challenge. Mm-hmm. Like, he was swallowed up by the Wolfman. Mm-hmm. But Lon Chaney,
and all the horror movies.
Right? And all the horror movies. But Lon Chaney was an actor.
Yeah.
And you forget that he's an actual presence. Mm-hmm. And I think what you get with this film, something that you just pointed out that I hadn't even thought about when I was thinking about it, the lack of music, it's almost like watching a play.
Yeah.
Like it has the energy of a play where it is the script, where it is the dialogue, where it is everything. And I think what I came away with is that this is a great film. And this is one of the films, you know, I've talked about films like this before, that when you're a kid and you say, oh, I like movies.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're thinking is you like good movies.
Yeah.
Because those are the ones that are shown. And then as you get older, you realize that there's a lot of crappy movies.
Right.
But the quality of this and the quality of, again, Stanley Kramer's direction. And you know, you look at the man's filmography where, you know, whether you're talking about Inherit the Wind, whether you're talking about this, whether you're talking about a few years after this, where he captures Sidney Poitier at a different speed with Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Yeah.
You know, this is a person that is in full control of all of the tools. While I think this is a great film, and I think he's great in it, I don't know if I would call it a great Sidney Poitier film, though.
Really?
I think Sidney Poitier is great in it, but what I was, because, and I've mentioned this before, where like, I really enjoy the Defiant Ones, but in my column of Sidney Poitier films, I'm never going to pick this to watch. Like, oh, let's watch a Sidney Poitier film. Like, it's not in my top five Sidney Poitier films.
Mm.
And I, you know, I always wonder if Ozzie Davis played this role or, you know, even a young Brock Peters.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how much the final product would have changed so that when we talk about it on this show, and, you know, obviously we're focusing on Sidney Poitier's performance. I think he's wonderful in it, but I don't know if this is a film that he's necessarily the strongest part or the part that sticks out or the part that says that, oh, I'm going to watch this for Sidney Poitier. As you've pointed out, Tony Curtis is just as strong as Sidney Poitier in this film. Mm-hmm. I think this script is bulletproof.
Mm-hmm.
I think Stanley Kramer's direction is masterful. Mm-hmm. So that there are so many components to it that it's a really interesting exercise for me, fitting it within the continuum of Sidney Poitier films, where, you know, something like In the Heat of the Night with Rod Steiger, where both of them are, you know, much like this, basically co-leads, but Sidney Poitier is this fully formed leading man.
Mm-hmm.
Or something like Uptown Saturday Night, where Sidney Poitier-ness, if you will, very specifically
bounces off of Bill Cosby, or even something like Buck and the Preacher, where, you know, I'm thinking of films where it's him
and someone where else,
it's,
right.
it's him and Harry Belafonte,
right?
And Sidney Poitier is entering into that 70s mode that we talked about, even with something like Brother John, where it's almost this haughtiness that he has.
Yeah, see, but I think that in this film, Sidney, and to the film's credit, because Tony Curtis' role is a little louder. It's not a loud role, right. But it's a louder.
Right. Well,
role.
He's the kinetic one. He's right. And then you know, he gets the love interest because he's the white guy.
Right.
You know, 1958.
But I think because of that, I think that Sidney is actually a very good choice for this.
Okay.
Because that inner anger that he has,
mm-hmm.
that you can see just boiling underneath the surface.
Yeah.
You know, it's always percolating. It's always there. And sometimes it pops for a split second, but then it doesn't.
Right.
And, you know, and no shade on Brock Peters, just to name the people that you named.
Right, right. I mean, he's a better actor than Brock Peters.
I think that Sidney gets that over better than the two of them would have. That's not to say that maybe somebody else couldn't. I said
Ozzie Davis. I meant to say a young James Earl Jones.
See, I was actually thinking maybe James Earl Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe James Earl Jones. Some might say Harry Belafonte, but I think Harry Belafonte. Well, I don't think Harry Belafonte could have done it. And right. I also think, you know, just being honest, for that role, I think you wanted a darker guy.
Absolutely. Just visually.
Which again, to a degree, lets out James Earl Jones as well.
Right.
So I think if you...
That's interesting, just physically.
Yeah, just talking on a physical aspect. Okay. You know? But I actually like Sidney Poitier in this role. I think that, especially considering what we had just seen him in, we just saw him in the Mark of the Hawk,
right?
You know what I mean? Which was a totally different type of role.
Yeah.
I think him doing something like this is Sidney, you know, trying not to be pigeonholed,
absolutely,
into a role and making this role his, so right. much so.
And this is 2 years after The Mark of the Hawk.
Right.
Yeah.
And he does it in such a way, so much so, that a role that could have been a supporting role. I think they're on the screen as much as each other, you know, as one another. But let's think of 1950s politics. If anyone had said he was the supporting role, probably a lot of people wouldn't have complained because he was the black guy.
Sure.
But he's so strong in that movie that you couldn't get away with giving him the supporting role. You had to give him the Oscar, the nomination right. for lead. And I think that speaks to how much he actually does fill that role. I actually think he's spot on it in this.
Well, the anger speaks to me. You know, that the argument for the anger, because you sort of look at where he is at this moment. You know, the career-wise. Next year he makes Porgy and Bess,
mm-hmm.
which that role, you have that anger. After that, have you ever seen All the Young Men?
I think I have.
I have no memory of All the Young Men at all.
Sounds familiar.
But then you go A Raisin in the Sun, mm-hmm. where it's that same thing, that kind of seething, smoldering anger that's mm-hmm. always there. Paris Blues is after that. Then he's a Moorish king in The Long Ships, which really the less said about The Long Ships, the better.
Although, I've never seen that movie.
Oh, he's got a magnificent beard thing going on in The Long
Oh,
Ship.
Is that, it's like he yeah, got his Fu Manchu.
Yeah, he's
on.
Got the Fu Manchu. Oh, it's the Fu Manchu.
I've seen that picture.
Right, right. Like, there's really no reason to watch The Long Ships except to look at Sidney Poitier in that Fu Manchu talking in a Moorish accent.
Oh my God.
It's pretty ridiculous.
Mm.
But then
you start to get the shift where you get the Sidney Poitier that is critiqued later on.
Yes.
Because, you know, then he does, you know, Lilies of the Field. Mm-hmm. He's Simon in The Greatest Story Ever Told. You get into A Patch of Blue. And then, now it's the Sidney Poitier that, frankly, white people find non-threatening.
Exactly.
Although, right. We've talked about To Serve with Love, I think it's more going on. But, okay, I'll go along with that. Go along with the Sidney, but I was again trying to figure out why do I never? I mean, even the films, like of all the films I just named, except of course for The Long Ships, I like all of them as Sidney Poitier films better than this.
Really,
I do. Which, let's be clear, I don't think that is a dig against the defiant ones.
No. It's all about preference.
Yeah, and I think Sidney Poitier had like for a 10-year period, it was just boom, 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 boom of Sidney Poitier showcased films. Mm-hmm. Like, let's be clear, I don't think A Patch of Blue is a better film than the defiant ones, but I think A Patch of Blue is a better showcase of Sidney Poitier.
Okay.
Stuff. But yeah, it's a great film. It's a great film. You know, the film is so great that this is one of the few times we've looked at a film and my major critique of the film is that I wished it was longer.
Oh, really?
I do. Like, I could have spent another 10, maybe 15 minutes with Joker and Cullen on the run talking to him because, I think obviously the real showcase of this film is the two actors bouncing off of each other.
True.
And there's a surprising amount of screen time spent on the police chasing them,
especially in the beginning.
I mean,
like their whole setup.
Like, they keep going back to him, and it's this whole deal with the person who's in the posse with the dogs, and it's sort of this
don't eat in front of my dogs.
It's this weird interpersonal dynamic between the sheriff and the townspeople, and it's all very interesting.
It is interesting,
but the film's only an hour and 37 minutes.
I know.
So every moment that I spend with the sheriff sort of disregarding the man and his love for the dogs, that's time that I could have with Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier. And to be clear, I don't think you should lose that.
No, you shouldn't, because it's a very interesting, also adds to the commentary.
And again, the script is wonderful.
Yeah.
Like, just every spoken word, but I could have used 20 more minutes. Like, I could have used a solid 2 hours.
See, I'm actually good with it. I like it being this tight little, compact little film.
Mm-hmm.
I think the great films leave you wanting a little more. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and,
I hear
and
you. I think
this, and if you wanted a little bit longer, then you could go to the 1986. There was a TV movie version of The Defiant Ones.
Yeah.
Starring a Spencer for Hire Robert Urich and Action Jackson Carl Weathers.
Right. Now, why would I do that?
Well, it's longer.
It's just longer.
You wanted more time.
I wanted more. It's like, I feel like there's a monkey paw situation type of deal. Like, I've made a wish, but the wish sucks ass. It's like, wait a minute. And then, like, the little monkey finger goes down.
He said you wanted more.
I did. I wanted more Defiant Ones. And then the monkey paw, the finger goes down because I made my wish. Mm-hmm. And it's like, here it is. But it's Robert Urich and Carl Weathers.
Yes. Or maybe you want to go to the 1970s blaxploitation gender flip of this film, Black Mama, White Mama.
Okay.
With Pam Grier.
Ain't nothing wrong with Black Mama, White Mama. Let's be clear. That's a fine film.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. But great film. Great film.
Great.
Great, great film.
Great film. I mean, look, I will say this. I don't know if you can definitively call this a black film. I wouldn't call it a black film.
Right.
However, I think because of the commentary that it does have on race,
mm-hmm.
while not a black film, it's a film black people should see.
Right.
And I think they would enjoy
it. I would call it a black film. A, because if Cullen's character isn't black, the whole thing changes.
Yeah.
And then B, it is a film about race. And like I said, it has a surprisingly sophisticated examination of whiteness.
Oh, yeah.
But its examination of whiteness is in contrast
mm-hmm.
to blackness.
Yeah. Y'all can't lynch me. I'm a white man.
Right. And you know, and even, you know, there's that wonderful moment where Cullen says, no one gets as scared about a lynching as you did unless you've seen one.
Right.
And you know, and Joker, of course, says, yeah, they lynched a guy, this, they pulled him out of jail. And he doesn't say they lynched a black person. But the implication is right there.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, even the details of Joker eventually finding a way to escape and Cullen rightfully saying, oh, you're going to use me as bait. And Cullen's understanding how race works. And then, you know, as you say, he makes a sacrifice to go warn Cullen. Mm-hmm. Although I'd like to point out that for all that talk about we going to send you, I send him into the swamp and he's going to get eaten up by the swamp and he's going to die in the swamp. Cullen was fine.
True. Very true.
Cullen was actually fine.
Yes.
Cullen had time to smoke a cigarette and he was waiting for the train to come.
Yes.
Which, you know, I took that as, yeah, maybe you might get eaten up in the swamp.
Right.
But Cullen was fine.
But I'm a black man.
Right, exactly. Like all this, hey, I done told you for an hour and 30 minutes, I'm a black man. So all this that you talking about, it works differently for me.
In the immortal words of Bane,
I was raised in the shadows.
Exactly. But even that, I think that is there deliberately because just as Joker makes this sacrifice for this man who has become his brother, Cullen makes a similar sacrifice.
Yeah.
And I think you're absolutely right. It's a credit to a script that is sparse. And in a lot of, I actually wrote in my notes, like, you know, there's a scene where they go across a river and they have to help each other. And it's a silent scene, but it's a perfect, you know, talking about teaching this in a class, it's a perfect depiction of show, not tell.
Yep.
So that by the end, you understand this link between them. And it's a great film.
Yeah.
It's a great film.
You should watch it, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. I was about to say, so would you recommend?
You should watch The Defiant Ones, the 1958 version.
Right.
Except no substitutes.
I agree. You should absolutely watch it. And, you know, frankly, you should watch Stephen Kramer films. Stanley Kramer. I was about to say I'm a fan. I'm such a fan that I mess his name up. But I'm actually a fan of Stanley Kramer. Like this is good, solid, blue chip filmmaking right here.
Did you know, a couple of pieces of trivia before we get out of this, that the movie Toy Story,
yes,
the animated movie, the John Lasseter, who was the head of Pixar at the time,
yeah,
wrote that he based the relationship of Woody and Buzz Lightyear on Joker and Cullen.
No, I didn't. That's hilarious.
Isn't that?
Yeah.
And did you know that The Defiant Ones features the last film of one of the great Hollywood child actors?
No, I didn't. Who? Who's in it?
Carl Switzer.
And we know Carl Switzer.
Because Carl Switzer was Alfalfa from Our Gang.
The Little Rascals. I did actually know that. Now, he died in a bar fight or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
I didn't know that.
I think it was like from injuries.
I was about to say he got stabbed up.
Right.
Yeah. He actually did know that. I forgot, but yeah.
He plays the character of Angus,
mm-hmm.
the guy that is always running around with the radio.
Yes. And he actually looks like Alfalfa.
He looked like somebody. Yeah. I didn't know.
Like, and I was trying to figure out who. Yeah.
That's interesting.
That's a great piece of trivia.
A little piece of trivia.
Any more trivia? No more trivia? No,
that's not a trivia.
That's good trivia.
That's good.
All right. So, yeah. All right. The Defiant Ones.
Yes.
All right.
So check it out, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. Yes.
Check out the Defiant Ones. All right. Okay. Well, hey, next week is October.
Yes, it is.
Which means that we will be starting our month of horror movies.
Yes, we will.
Oh, boy. So before we tell you what our first horror movies, which Vince will be choosing.
I will begin the month.
We invite all of you to like and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Michaud Mission. Join the Facebook group at Michaud Mission. Also, you can email us all of your thoughts and concerns and questions or what have you to MichaudMission@gmail.com. Check us out. Our show is available as a podcast on the Podglomerate Podcast Network, thepodglomerate.com. They just kicked off a new podcast, A History of Stand-Up with Wayne Fetterman.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Speaking of stand-up.
It's actually pretty cool. I checked out. And our show is also available for your download and streaming pleasure on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud, and any place and every place the good podcasts are. And you can check us out as a radio show Saturdays at 1 p.m. on WPPM 106.5 FM, City of Brotherly Love, People Power Media, Philly Cam. And spend your Monday mornings with Michaud on 91.7 FM WKDU, the voice of Drexel University. That's Monday mornings at 9 a.m. with the Michaud Mission. That's MichaeuX Mission. Spell that out and everything.
Yes, you did.
All right. Vince.
Yes.
What will be our first haunt on Halloween 2018?
Well, you know, for 2 years and 8 episodes, I have skipped and avoided this film to the point where even before I came in tonight, because I knew I was up, I knew I would get to this month, and Sugar Hill is one of mine. I thought about choosing Ghost Dad. Ugh. It has a ghost. That will legitimately be a Halloween episode, correct? Correct. That would legitimately.
I suppose.
I thought about Ghost Dad. I thought about Petey Wheatstraw, the devil's son-in-law, starring the great Rudy Ray Moore.
Oh, Lord.
I mean, it's got supernatural elements to it. But at this point, it really is shameful that we have not talked about a film that legitimately frightened me to the point that I think I've only seen it once.
I think I know where we're going.
1992 film,
mm-hmm.
directed by Bernard Rose, based on a story by horror master Clive Barker,
mm-hmm.
starring
the
really underrated Virginia Madsen.
I love me some Virginia Madsen.
Early appearance by Vanessa Williams.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Vanessa Williams, not Vanessa L. Williams, but no. Vanessa Williams, mm-hmm. the actress. And in the lead role, Mr. Tony Todd.
Mm.
I am, of course, talking about 1992's Candyman.
It scared you, huh?
Candyman scared the shit out of me in 1992.
You gonna watch it with the entire family?
No, but I'm gonna watch it at 10 in the morning with all the shades open. So to begin our month of horror films.
This'll be fun.
Candyman.
I actually just watched Candyman again, probably about a year ago.
Okay, obviously we'll talk about this much more next week, but does it hold up?
We'll talk about it next week.
Okay.
All right. Candyman. Check it out, ladies and gentlemen. That's where we're going. It's Halloween! Okay. All right. I have no idea where that came from.
I don't know.
We got to get out of here. He's Vince. I'm Len. In parting, we say,
we'll see you when it's time to meet again.
It's time to bid adieu. It's been a pleasure knowing you. I'll see you when it's time to meet again.